Now, shall we begin?
The state of Idaho, as embodied in the persons of District Judge Marvin Smith, Deputy Bonneville County Prosecutor John Stosich, and Assistant Attorney General Jack Haycock, had repeatedly and explicitly threatened to kill Michael Whiteley. Whiteley was charged with first-degree kidnapping and rape, which he was told constituted a capital offense. The very best he could hope for, if he were found guilty of those charges, would be life in prison. Whiteley's supposed victim was a morally deranged and psychologically unstable woman from Bolivia named Sylvia Canedo. He had been briefly married to Canedo, but that union was annulled after Whiteley learned that she was still legally married to a man in Bolivia named Carlos Almanza. Canedo withheld that fact from Michael Whiteley when she persuaded him to marry her. In contemporaneous phone conversations with her mother, Raquel Gonzalez, Canedo made repeated and explicit disclosure of the fact that she was consciously marrying Michael Whiteley in spite of the fact that she was still legally married to another man. She was admitting, in other words, to a conscious act of bigamy, which was a felony offense at the time. This would have been in September and October of 1990. The only evidence against Michael Whiteley that he had kidnapped and supposedly raped Sylvia Canedo in January of 1991 consisted of the self-contradictory and previously recanted claim by the supposed victim. Prior to the trial in May of 1991, Whiteley was offered a plea bargain by the state of Idaho, which had taken over prosecution of this case after the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office had been disqualified because of the misconduct of Deputy Prosecutor Stosich. The state of Idaho offered to drop the charge of rape entirely and to reduce the kidnapping charge from first to second degree. Second degree kidnapping still carried a potential sentence of 25 years to life. However, once the rape charge had been dropped, it would no longer be a capital offense. Rather than facing a mandatory 12-year prison sentence, Whiteley was offered the prospect of 4 months of treatment at the Cottonwood Addiction Facility, during which period the judge would retain jurisdiction of the case, after which the charges would be dropped, and he would be a free man, assuming that he left the state of Idaho forever. There would be no guarantee, of course, that the judge would accept that agreement, but the judge had indicated that he was receptive to this plea bargain as a way of simply expediting the case. The alternatives that confronted Michael Whiteley at this time were either the prospect of life in prison or even potentially execution, because the judge would retain the authority to decide the sentence if Whiteley were convicted of this offense. And bear in mind, once again, the only evidence against Whiteley consisted of the unsupported word of the accuser, or 4 months in a not particularly unpleasant therapeutic facility. "I have to plead not guilty, Your Honor," declared Whiteley. "This is not a game. This is no joke, because I feel under that plea that I have been, I don't know if you'd call it coerced, maybe not threatened and stuff, but more or less coerced, and whether it be in fear of my wife and my family or what, I had originally intended to plead the other way," continued Whiteley. "But now that I sit here and run it through my heart and my mind, I don't feel, Your Honor, that it is right to lie." If you want to know what the word integrity means, there's a pretty suitable definition. Even facing the prospect of life in prison and potential execution, with the alternative being a not particularly onerous sentence at a therapeutic facility, Michael Whiteley knew he didn't commit that offense. And that is why the state of Idaho, in an outburst of arrogant, vindictive fury, went after Michael Whiteley hammer and tongs and succeeded in convicting him because of the tragic credulity of a southeastern Idaho jury on a charge of first-degree kidnapping and rape, and Whiteley has spent the last 25 years of his life in prison, where he will most likely die. He is currently 67 years old and in very poor health. What is most infuriating about this case is the fact that Whiteley appears to have been framed for a kidnapping and rape committed by an Idaho Falls police officer. After he was arrested on January 18th of 1991, Whiteley learned that during his 28-day marriage to Canito, she had already begun a relationship with a second man named Keith McCabe, whom she would later marry after Whiteley had been arrested and detained on the rape and kidnapping charge. Several weeks earlier, following the annulment of his marriage to Sylvia, Whiteley discovered, in what was probably the worst way imaginable, that she had become pregnant, and he was not the father, nor was McCabe. In two letters that Canito later filed with the court, she said that the child was conceived as a result of an act that could only be characterized as rape through extortion coupled with kidnapping. The offender, and once again, this is according to Sylvia's account, was Idaho Falls police officer Rick Hansen, who, as it happens, retired from the Idaho Falls Police Department just a few months ago. Mr. Hansen, your name is a matter of record in a document that has been recognized by the court. These are Sylvia Canito's accusations, not mine. According to Sylvia Canito, Hansen inveigled her into having sex after he witnessed her pull a knife on Michael Whiteley's 14-year-old son, Jay. In September of 1999, more than 8 years after Whiteley had been convicted of kidnapping and raping her, Sylvia Canito wrote and signed two letters recanting her accusations against him. She filed them with the court. They were not provided to Michael Whiteley until several years later, after they were discovered by one of his appellate attorneys. In those letters, she described the unborn child as the policeman Hansen's baby, who was conceived after the incident in which she threatened Whiteley's son. She said that Hansen threatened to put me in the jail if I do not make love to him, and my family would take my kids. Because I was in fear to lose my kids, I make love to him. He took me to a place off the road, I do not know the name of it, and he gave to me his baby, and when he found out, he told my mommy and other people that I have to get rid of the baby or Michael will use that against him, and we can both go to jail. So I pushed Michael to take me to Utah to kill the baby. In the preliminary hearings prior to Michael Whiteley's trial, the state repeatedly emphasized that kidnapping occurs whenever one forcibly conveys another person for any distance, however trivial. That's the specific phrase used by the prosecution. According to Sylvia Canito's statement in 1999, Rick Hansen kidnapped her, took her to a place by the side of the road, and then using the leverage of a threat against her and against her children, forced her to have sex with him. The statutory definition of rape in the state of Idaho does not require the use of a weapon. It does not require the use of physical compulsion. As that statute was applied in the pretrial hearings regarding Michael Whiteley, it was made clear that psychological pressure to have sex with an unwilling partner constitutes rape. Ergo, according to Sylvia Canito's accusations once again, and apparently her accusations, uncorroborated by physical evidence, were sufficient to convict one man of kidnapping and rape, Michael Whiteley. According to her 1999 statements, which she later admitted in a sworn deposition she had written and signed, according to those statements, Rick Hansen raped her, kidnapped her, and raped her, thereby committing what Michael Whiteley was told was a capital offense in the state of Idaho. And once again, according to her account, and her account was considered to be self-validating as it applied to Michael Whiteley, according to her account, Rick Hansen later pressured her into having Michael take her down to Utah in order to abort the child. I will have a great deal more to say about this utterly bizarre case when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
She was just dragging me along, using me for everything she could do before winding me up in here. Just, on the second trip when we finally had that done, we got this black looking foot exit heading north, okay? And she turned to me and says, Michael, that baby I just killed was the policeman Hansen's from when I pulled a knife on Jay. put me in the jail unless I make love to him. And that's when he gave me his baby. In her recant letter, September 1999, she elaborates on that.
Shortly after the incident in which Sylvia Canito pulled a knife on Michael Whiteley and his 14-year-old son, Jay, she filed a complaint against him, claiming that he and his son had pulled a knife against her. Unlike the first case, which was witnessed by a law enforcement officer, Rick Hansen, who, according to Sylvia Canito's subsequent disclosures, used that fact to extract sexual favors from her, the only supposed evidence of the second incident of aggravated assault was the word, the unsupported word of the accuser. Yet Whiteley was arrested and charged with aggravated assault. In December of 1990, Bonneville County Prosecutor Kimball Mason, who would later be arrested and convicted of gun running, interestingly enough, released Whiteley through an arrangement that he called sundown bail, which was a kind of extrajudicial banishment. Whiteley was told that the charge and an existing civil protection order would be dropped against him if he left Idaho permanently. Whiteley, unfortunately, still had family and possessions in Bonneville County. He had to return to Idaho Falls covertly, and he discovered that Sylvia Canito would not leave him alone. Knowing the risks of doing so, Whiteley returned to Idaho Falls to make arrangements to relocate back to Nevada, where they had previously lived. While he was in Idaho Falls, Sylvia made contact and informed him that she was pregnant, and as she would later write, she pushed him to take me to Utah to kill that baby. Because he couldn't stay for long in Idaho without risking arrest, and acting in the desperate hope that this would finally and definitively close a thoroughly unpleasant chapter in his life, Whiteley did as Sylvia asked. The day after he returned to Idaho Falls, that would have been January 17th, if memory serves, January 17th of 1991, as he was gathering some personal effects from Sylvia's house, Whiteley was attacked by her mother, Raquel Gonzalez, who struck him several times in the back and shoulders with a baseball bat. He was leaning against his car collecting himself when Idaho Falls police officer Jared Furman, who would later become properly notorious for his role in the wrongful conviction of Christopher Tapp, arrived on the scene. By this time, Raquel had been relieved of the weapon by Bishop Saunders, who was using it to threaten Whiteley. Rather than arresting Raquel or Bishop Saunders, Furman arrested Whiteley for violating a civil protection order. That order of protection, interestingly, contained the following supplemental order, which I am reading from a copy of the document I have on my desk. It is further ordered that this order shall automatically terminate at 11:59 p.m. on the 6th day of February of 1990, unless this order is renewed by order of the court. 1990. This order was invalid by 344 days, either through a clerical oversight or deliberate mischief on the part of Judge Riddick, who signed that document. That order was invalid at the time that Jared Furman arrested Michael Whiteley, which means that that arrest itself was invalid. Whiteley was not arrested for kidnapping until later that day while he was already in the custody of the IFPD, and he wasn't informed of the rape charge until his arraignment several days later. After taking Whiteley into an interrogation room, Furman, using the techniques of subtle coercion and deception in which he had been trained, sought to extract self-incriminating statements from his victim. He first beguiled Whiteley into signing a Miranda waiver, which is something you should never do. He assured him that the only thing being sought in this casual conversation was his side of the story regarding the confrontation at the home of Sylvia Canito a few hours earlier. Besides, Furman said, Whiteley would be better off talking with him, or he would be turned over to what he called the big guys, who wouldn't be nearly as considerate. Whiteley, at some point, requested an attorney. Furman parried that request by saying that it wouldn't be necessary, and besides, it was too early in the day to call one. He worked on the captive for several hours while getting updates on the story being told by Sylvia and her mother, who were being questioned in a separate room. Whiteley was told that he would have to write out what was called a voluntary statement describing the events of the past few days, including the trip to Utah during which Sylvia aborted her child. At this point, bear in mind, Whiteley had no idea that he was suspected of kidnapping Sylvia, let alone of raping her. Thus, when Furman asked if he and Sylvia had engaged in intercourse during the trip to Utah, Whiteley, who, recall, had been denied access to an attorney, admitted that they had, but he described it as consensual. This was reflected in his handwritten voluntary statement. However, as Furman became more overtly demanding and more obliquely threatening, Whiteley had misgivings about the statement and he refused to sign it. Furman arrested Whiteley on a charge of kidnapping, and then after Whiteley had been taken away, forged his name on that statement. He would later testify under oath at a pretrial hearing that he had witnessed Whiteley sign that voluntary statement. After Whiteley's defense attorney, Stephen Thompson, challenged that claim, the original document was produced in court, and Furman, rather than being charged with perjury, and perjury has been a leitmotif of Jared Furman's career, was allowed to revise his testimony, admitting that he had signed Whiteley's name to the statement and describing this act as standard procedure, which would be an institutional indictment of the IFPD, which is a department that is thoroughly clotted with corruption. The following day, Sylvia called the jail to speak with Whiteley. Now, this would have been a violation of the civil order of protection, and this was entirely in keeping with a long and well-documented history of Sylvia filing protection orders against Whiteley and then violating them herself by driving past his home, by calling him on the telephone. She called the jail several times, as a matter of fact. Those calls were recorded by jail officials in message memos, of which I have copies. At his first opportunity, Whiteley made a return collect phone call from the jail. He didn't know that the prosecutor, John Stosich, was at Sylvia's home, that he was the one who accepted the charges for that collect call, and that he was equipped with a tape recorder to document the conversation. Nor did he realize until well into that conversation that Stosich was prompting Sylvia to ask questions that were crafted for the purpose of eliciting self-incriminating answers from Whiteley. What Whiteley heard on his end of the conversation was a distraught woman who was worried about losing her children and being sent back to an abusive husband in Bolivia. He pleaded with her to drop the charges and do whatever was necessary to get him out of jail, which is where he did not belong. When she asked if she should lie in order to set him free, Whiteley believed that she was thinking of protecting herself, given her criminal exposure, rather than acting on his behalf, so he replied, "Do whatever you have to." When Sylvia asked Whiteley if he was sorry, Whiteley replied that he was sorry for everything about their brief, tempestuous, and unpleasant affair. Stosich, who was scripting this exchange from behind the scenes, would later claim that Whiteley was apologizing for raping Sylvia. Whiteley only heard one half of that conversation. He didn't hear the conversation that Stosich was confecting out of the remarks that he was making to Sylvia. And bear in mind, once again, Sylvia was the one who called Whiteley, not the other way around. As I have said before, if you don't hate prosecutors, you're simply not paying attention. I'll be back shortly.
Let's talk about that for a moment. He paid for the groceries. And then what?
We went out to the car, and that's it.
When'd you shoot him?
What?
At what point did you shoot the clerk?
I shot the clerk.
Yes, when did you shoot him?
I shot the clerk.
Hey, Dean, we need you out here.
I'm in the middle of a damn confession here. asked him if he did it, and he said, I shot the clerk. I asked him again, and again he said, I shot the clerk.
Your Honor, no further questions.
Michael, now I know that you are my love, my world. Te amo, that's Spanish for I love you. Te amo, te amo, te amo, te amo. Te amo, te amo, te amo, te amo, te amo. Te amo, te amo, te amo, te amo, te amo. Miguel, te amo mucho, I love you very much. Te amo, mi amor, Silvia. That was from a birthday card sent from Silvia Canedo to Michael Whiteley in the fall of 1990. At a time when she would later testify, Michael Whiteley was supposedly forcing her to marry him. During the May 1991 trial of Michael Whiteley for kidnapping and rape, Silvia Canedo testified that she had never intended to marry Michael, that she was still legally married to Carlos Almanza, her husband in Bolivia, and that somehow, using some means that were not specified, Michael Whiteley forced her to marry him. During cross-examination by the defense attorney, Mr. Stephen Thompson, we can read the following exchange. As I recall your testimony, it was basically that marriage was really against your will because of mental pressure my client was placing on you. Is that correct? Can I explain that? Asked Sylvia. Just answer, is that correct? Yes. In other words, she's testifying that she did not intend to marry Michael, this notwithstanding this rather embarrassing birthday card that she had sent him in which she repeatedly professed her undying love for him. To impeach her testimony, Thompson entered into evidence, and this was accepted by the court, a tape recording of a conversation that Sylvia had, contemporaneous with the sending of this postcard, with her mother, Raquel Gonzalez. That conversation was conducted in Spanish. There was an interpreter present. At one point early in the conversation, there was a comment to the effect that somebody had been threatening to kill Sylvia. That person was obviously not Michael Whiteley, because Sylvia repeatedly asserted, in the teeth of her mother's outraged insistence to the contrary, that she was going to marry Michael Whiteley. Raquel told her, Carlos has told her that the children will live with Michael over his dead body. Carlos, once again, was Carlos Almanza, Sylvia's first husband in Bolivia. So then you've told him? Replied Sylvia. How mean you are, Mommy, how mean. She was clearly threatened by Carlos Almanza and frightened of him. Do you know what I am going to do? I'm going to call the police, Sylvia said, and I'm going to have them pick up the children because you guys don't have any right to do whatever you want. Raquel replied, he says that he is going to the embassy tomorrow. Sylvia, let him go to the embassy. Let him go wherever he wants. Raquel, if you do that, he's not going to give you the divorce. Sylvia, I don't care. I'm going to get married regardless. You know why? For the home abandonment. And also I'm going to tell them that he was raping an employee in Bolivia. Raquel, well, and you know what? Sylvia, what? Raquel, you have abandoned your children. Sylvia, so then you guys have stabbed me in the back. Raquel, who has stabbed you in the back? Sylvia, are you telling me that you have called Carlos? Raquel, I have called him because I don't know where you are. Sylvia, very well, very well. Now this evening I'm going off and marry Michael. Raquel, unintelligible, that she is going to marry that man no matter what, and I don't want the children to go and live with Michael, because Michael is this way and that way, and he has said yes, that. Sylvia, thank you for stabbing me in the back, Mommy. Raquel, he will sign the divorce, he has said, as long as you are not going to bed. Sylvia, do you know what? I have not lived with that Carlos, with that son of a bitch for 2 years. And Carlos was the one that raped an employee one day. Ask, I have witnesses. Raquel. And Michael, how many girls could he have raped? Sylvia, he has not raped anybody. Raquel, nobody? Sylvia, but thank you for stabbing me in the back and for leaving me out in the street. Raquel, you say you're calling the police. Unintelligible. Never ever with Michael. Unintelligible. Sylvia, yeah, it's that you're leaving me out on the street. You're taking the home away from me, you tell me. You're telling me to pay you for the car. Why? So that later on I won't have a place to live. The conversation proceeds rather confusingly for several more minutes, picking it up a little bit further downstream. Raquel, expressing skepticism that Michael actually intended to marry Sylvia, asks, or at least does he have the license? He is unintelligible. I'm going to put him in jail. Sylvia, Michael is divorced. Do you want to see the paper? Do you want to see the paper? Raquel, not just the paper. Sylvia, do you want to see the entire divorce decree? Raquel, I'm going to go to court. Sylvia, go to court tomorrow, on Monday. Raquel, now another thing, what I don't want is for him to set foot in your house or my house either. Sylvia, he doesn't want to. He doesn't want to. Picking it up yet a little bit further downstream. I'm telling you so that there won't be any problems, Mommy, said Sylvia. So that there won't be any problems, I'll tell you, because if I would have said that I'm going to go with Michael, and I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that, I'd have to listen to you. I'm 33 years old, I'm not a little girl. And now you want your children to be at your side, complained Raquel. Sylvia, I want to bring them here to live. Raquel, the thing is that you don't respect your children, nor do you love them. Sylvia, Mommy, they have to be with me. The kids, even if they don't like it. Raquel, no, they're not going to be, Sylvia. Sylvia, what? Raquel, they're going to stay at least 3 months with me. You are going to see how your marriage is going to be a disaster. Sylvia, it's not going to be because Michael loves me, Mommy. I reiterate, at this point, according to her subsequent testimony, Sylvia supposedly didn't want to get married to Michael. He was purportedly forcing her to marry him. And here she is pleading with her mother using largely unarticulated but inferentially obvious threats involving Sylvia's violent first husband and control over her kids. Her mother is trying to get her not to marry Michael, and Sylvia is insisting that she would marry Michael because she believed that he loved her. Raquel, well, he's going to leave you. Sylvia, Mommy, Michael loves me, and for that reason we... Raquel, no, he doesn't. Sylvia, listen to one thing. Raquel, he doesn't love the children. Sylvia, he loves them. He loves Alvaro. Ask him. Raquel, unintelligible, because there's crosstalk going on. The children have to be taken care of. Sylvia, ask Alvaro if he doesn't love him, Mommy. Raquel, no, no, he only wins Alvaro over with Nintendo and bad movies. Sylvia, unintelligible. Raquel, nuh-uh. If the man wants to marry you, fine. Let the children alone. Let them go routinely to their classes. Let them have someone that will give. Sylvia, no. Well, then keep them there for 3 months and ask them if they're going to be, and don't tell me, and don't call me crying, telling me that Alvaro was having problems with Julie and Tatiana. Still further downstream, there's a discussion of money that Sylvia believes that she is owed from her mother and from her first husband. And that money that is in the house is, I've had it for 10 years that I have been married with Carlos. Raquel, it's your children's. Sylvia, it's mine too, because I was with that man all the time, and he has beat me and all. Like many conversations of its kind, this tape-recorded phone call between Sylvia Canedo and her mother Raquel Gonzalez quickly became entropic. But several things are clear. First of all, Sylvia was determined to marry Michael Whiteley. She professed to believe earnestly that he loved her, and she was willing to undertake this marriage despite her mother's vehement opposition and despite threats against her and her children from her mother and from her then-lawful husband, Carlos Almanza. Sylvia was convinced that Almanza was a rapist, and he had beaten her on many occasions. They had not been living together for about 2 years prior to her arrival from Bolivia in Idaho Falls, and yet she was still afraid of potential retaliation from Carlos Almanza. He was going to go to the embassy and use whatever influence he possessed, which apparently was quite formidable, in order to retaliate against Sylvia. In his summation to the jury a few days later, Thompson pointed out that Sylvia admitted when she talked to her mother during this tape-recorded conversation that she did not tell her that she was already married to Michael Whiteley. Sylvia testified that she didn't really want to marry Michael back in October of 1990. She did that against her will. Again, I think the tape-recorded conversation between her mother and herself directly contradicts that, pointed out Thompson. It is 180 degrees from what you heard her say, which is incredible to me as I listen to what she says and then listen to one of those tapes. I don't think you can come away with any other conclusion but that she is playing games someplace, asserted Thompson. I don't think it is because she is unsophisticated and she is being manipulated by my client. The only evidence against Michael Whiteley, once again, consisted of the story told by Sylvia Canito, who was manifestly untrustworthy. And yet a jury, composed of citizens from southeastern Idaho who had been steeped in authoritarian doctrines of submission to leaders, found that sufficient to convict him. And 25 years later, he's dying in prison. I'll return momentarily.
We don't have any old times. I just don't want you pulling a pistol out of anywhere.
You missed a spot.
Can't miss a place you've never been.
Marriage is hard work, Mal. I know it. That doesn't mean we should just give up. Sure, we've had our spats. Maybe I made some bad decisions along the way.
No, you are a tweaked one, you are.
But face it, hubby. I'm really hot.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me the first time that he always started promising you the world as you call it, directed attorney Jeffrey W. Banks, as he questioned Sylvia Canito, who by this time could be called Martha Sylvia Canito Almanza Whiteley McCabe Commander. This happened during a May 2007 deposition in Bonneville County. Banks was representing an 83-year-old man by the name of John Commander. He was seeking to annul his brief marriage to Sylvia. He was her fourth and, as far as I know, last husband. They married in 2006, shortly after Sylvia dissolved her 14-year marriage to Keith McCabe. Within a few days of the wedding, Sylvia had enticed this octogenarian, who had become a widower himself a few years earlier, to purchase a $300,000 annuity on her behalf through AIG. The agreement to buy that annuity was memorialized in a document signed by both John and Sylvia. During the May 2007 deposition, indignant after being accused of being a gold digger, demanded another $300,000, and she insisted that John had promised her. He gave me this paper because he didn't want anybody to say, I will force him to say, hey, John, you need to give me this $600 or $300, whatever, Sylvia testified. So he said, keep this in case they want to know, because he always promised me to give me the $600,000 plus the stamp collection and the silver collection, the gold and what else, I don't know, some other things. You keep using this term, always promised you, observed Banks. Sylvia said this was because I was his princess. I was his lover, I was his wife. Turning then to the ailing 83-year-old man, Sylvia spat at him, I don't like how your kids say always, I am a gold digger, because I'm not. And then she immediately told Banks, I am demanding the other $300,000. Somewhat puzzled, Banks asked Sylvia to explain why she felt entitled to $600,000 from Commander. Quote, don't you see how pretty I am? He loved me. Just days after the wedding in 2006, Sylvia, with the help of a local investment counselor named Todd Johnson, who was suspected of being her paramour, persuaded Commander to take out a mortgage on a home in Idaho Falls that would be occupied by Johnson and Sylvia's daughter, Tatiana. Commander paid the $20,000 for down payment on the house and signed a warranty deed along with Sylvia. Sylvia then cashed out her annuity, taking a $72,000 penalty, and then embarked on a frenzied spending spree. Tens of thousands of dollars were used to purchase Hummers and BMWs that were shipped to Bolivia by way of a port in Virginia. Sylvia later admitted under oath in the May 2007 deposition that she had, quote, connections in customs through which she conducted those transactions. Additional tens of thousands of dollars in cash were withdrawn by Sylvia from several bank accounts that were held under several different names, and then sent to Bolivia by means of a woman named Paula Yanez, whom Sylvia described as a cousin. Yanez briefly resided in Salt Lake City, but remained in Bolivia after Sylvia's marriage to Commander was annulled. She, in other words, was being used to ferry cash in unspecified amounts to unspecified destinations in Bolivia. In addition to all of these cash transactions, Sylvia made numerous wire transfers, including one to the Hotel Diplomat in Cochabamba, Bolivia, which was at or near the last identified address of her long-estranged first husband, Carlos Almanza, the man whom she had supposedly fled from Bolivia to Idaho Falls, the man she had accused of raping women employed by him, whom she had accused of beating her. She was sending him money. At this point, it might be relevant to point out that Michael Whiteley recalled seeing photographs of Mr. Almanza surrounded by guns and stacks of cash. Within just a few days of purchasing the house in Idaho Falls, Sylvia signed a quitclaim deed giving it to Tatiana and to Todd Johnson. They had the title to the property, and John Commander was stuck with the mortgage payments. In December of 2007, a civil trial was scheduled to be held regarding the annulment of the marriage and demands made by John Commander for the return of his property. According to an affidavit later filed on behalf of Commander, defendant claimed to be incompetent, emotionally unstable, and unable to manage her own affairs. At trial, defendant appeared with her psychiatrist and claimed she had been hospitalized the night before for psychiatric issues. Prior to the trial, defendant and I attempted to settle this case, recalls Commander. The proposed settlement was based on her returning to my possession the diamond ring that was my deceased wife's. That diamond ring had been appraised for over $10,000. Defendant delivered my deceased wife's wedding ring to me, but the diamonds had been removed and replaced with glass. Since that time, Sylvia has resided in Bolivia. Some of you might be acquainted with Michael Levine. Michael Levine was the most highly decorated undercover operative in the history of the Drug Enforcement Administration. He is now an internationally recognized expert witness with a specific focus on the recruitment and supervision of confidential informants. He is also, naturally enough, an outspoken critic of the so-called war on drugs and the DEA in particular. In a recent letter to Michael Levine, I provided him with a biographical sketch and profile of Sylvia Canedo and her conduct. On the basis of your training, background, and experience, I asked Levine, what would you offer as a credible and likely explanation or explanations for her behavior? William, wrote Mr. Levine, my opinion is that her profile fits exactly with that of a sociopath professional CI or confidential informant. I can almost guarantee you that, particularly as a Bolivian international mover with no moral compass, she is being protected by at least the DEA and possibly other agencies like ICE, FBI, or CIA. It's sad, but I field lots of cases like this. Out of the short-lived marriage to John Commander, we've managed to extract a voluminous record showing that Sylvia Canedo was never the ingenue that she pretended to be. She was not the hapless, unsophisticated Bolivian immigrant. She's a sociopathic, predatory criminal. In some legal circles in Bonneville County, she is known as the Black Widow. The one critical piece of evidence that came out of her May 2007 deposition in the dissolution of marriage with John Commander is her admission that she signed the letters retracting the accusations against Michael Whiteley in 1999. Sylvia had written her first letter of retraction shortly after Michael's conviction on rape and kidnapping charges in 1991. In 1996, Michael Whiteley was granted a post-conviction hearing, an evidentiary hearing. Sylvia Canedo was sworn and placed on the witness stand, and asked about her previous accusations that Michael Whiteley had abducted her and raped her. She pleaded the Fifth Amendment 71 times on the advice of counsel, knowing that she faced exposure for perjury and a number of other very serious criminal offenses. During the May 2007 deposition in the annulment proceeding involving John Commander, Banks repeatedly tried to ask Sylvia Canito about the 1996 hearing and about the 1999 letters retracting her accusations against Whiteley. She adamantly refused to answer any questions and threatened to leave the deposition. She claimed that she had been instructed by both her attorney and by the judge not to answer any questions having to do with the Michael Whiteley case. The deposition went on a little bit longer than had been anticipated, and Banks, in what I consider to be a pretty brilliant legal maneuver, somewhat akin to Inspector Columbo's familiar routine of, "Excuse me, just one more question, sir." As Canito is champing at the bit to get out of that room and end the deposition, he brought this question up again. "I am handing you what's been marked as Exhibits 13 and 14, he told her. 13 and 14 were the two letters of retraction she had written in 1999. "I want you to look at those. Did you write those?" She replied, "I am not going to answer because this is like in the court, and they shouldn't have these here, and I won't answer because it's totally out of..." At this point, Banks interrupted. "There is a signature on the last page of Exhibit number 13. Is that your signature? Did you sign this in 1999? Sylvia replied, "I am not going to answer, so don't ask me any more. Exhibit number 14 also appears to have your signature. I am not going to answer in any language. Why won't you answer questions about..." "Because it doesn't apply," she replied. "I'm just asking, did you type these documents?" "No." "Did you sign them?" "The guy made me sign, and I am not going to answer any more." She admitted to signing these documents, while clinging to the entirely implausible pretense, who had been in prison for 8 years by that time, who didn't know about the existence of those letters until several years later when they were provided to him through discovery from his appellate counsel, that he somehow forced her to sign these letters. The gravamen, the legally significant fact here, is that she admitted under oath that she did sign these letters retracting the accusations against Michael Whiteley. At some point after those letters were signed and provided to the court, somebody compelled Canito to sign a notarized affidavit attesting that she had not written or signed those letters. And yet here she is in May of 2007 saying under oath, "Yes, I did sign those letters." This alone should be sufficient to bring about another evidentiary hearing, or preferably a new trial for Michael Whiteley. This has been known for almost 10 years, and yet still he sits in prison. Bonneville County and the state of Idaho threatened to kill Michael Whiteley in 1991. And the state of Idaho remains perversely determined that he will die in prison, a wrongfully convicted innocent man. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com and at thelibertarianinstitute.org. I will return next week, and until then, as always, dum spirito pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight him until we can't.